On the agenda for G7 leaders in Hiroshima, Japan, the increase in nuclear weapons and a worrying path ahead.
Countries are likely to become more forward-leaning on their nuclear doctrine in terms of their willingness to use nuclear weapons.
Also today in Ukraine, it's Vyshyivanka Day, a celebration of Ukrainian culture by wearing elaborate embroidered clothing.
It's the symbol of Ukrainian struggle, and this symbol of national clothes is very big right now.
In the midst of war, a traditional shirt is more than just a garment. I'm Marco Werman. Plus, where the rubber meets the road, tiny particles that come off of our tires are really bad for us, but good for business.
Underlying the whole industry, of course, is a business model that focuses on churn.
And there's a whole bunch of churn coming up with the transition to electric cars. All that today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. President Biden is in Japan today. Tomorrow he'll meet with other leaders of the G7 countries. That would be Japan, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and the UK. They will have a busy agenda: the war in Ukraine, tensions with China, trade, climate change. But Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida also wants to discuss nuclear weapons. That's why he chose to host a summit in Hiroshima, the first city on Earth to be struck by an atomic bomb. James Acton is co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's in Washington. James, you've been to Hiroshima. What will Joe Biden and other world leaders see when they visit the Hiroshima Peace Memorial tomorrow?
What they're going to see is the dome in Hiroshima, which was partially destroyed during the explosion, and is this very visual and moving reminder of the attack. And then there's also the museum there. And I believe that they're going to go and see at least parts of the museum, which describes the attack and its aftermath.
What do you think Kishida would like to hear from Joe Biden on nuclear weapons?
I think a lot of the focus right now is on risk reduction. Russia has just suspended its implementation in New START, which was the last surviving arms control agreement. Not only has it invaded another sovereign state, Ukraine, it's used nuclear threats. So this is not a security environment in which progress towards disarmament is possible. On the other hand, it's an environment in which the risk of nuclear use is rising quite dangerously, in my opinion. And I think in the short term, the kind of practical agenda that can be pursued is steps to try and reduce the risk of nuclear weapon use.
When you say the risk of a nuclear incident of some sort is rising, what do you look at specifically?
To start with, the risk of conventional war between two nuclear armed states. It's impossible to rule out the possibility that the United States and NATO could be engaged in a direct conflict against Russia over Ukraine. There's growing concerns about the possibility of a large-scale conventional conflict with China over Taiwan. Can't rule out the possibility of conflict on the Korean Peninsula, and then again in South Asia between India and Pakistan. So if you had a conventional conflict involving two nuclear armed states, it's possible that the state losing the war might escalate to nuclear weapons. It's possible that through miscalculation or misperception, you could have escalation. And even if the United States and NATO don't enter the war against Russia's war against Ukraine on the side of Ukraine, if things got really bad for Russia, it's impossible to exclude the fact that Russia might use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. So I think in all of these different ways, the risk of nuclear use is rising today.
The world's nations have been discussing nuclear non-proliferation since the Soviet Union got the bomb in 1949. Today, James Acton, what does non-proliferation mean?
Well, I mean, amongst the kind of nuclear wonkhood that I'm part of, we tend to use non-proliferation to mean preventing the spread of nuclear weapons to additional countries that don't otherwise possess them. You know, today, the key non-proliferation issue in particular is over Iran. And then separately, people often use the phrase non-proliferation to try to refer to reductions amongst existing nuclear weapon states. We tend to call that arms control or disarmament. And, you know, unfortunately, I think we're going in exactly the wrong direction there. I think we are seeing the emergence of a very clear three-way arms race involving Russia, China, and the United States right now. And my expectation is that over the next 10 to 20 years, nuclear weapon numbers are very likely to go up. Unfortunately, I think we're in for a fairly rough ride ahead over the next few years looking forward.
James, you were speaking about a three-way race between China, Russia, and the U.S. What would make you less worried about that scenario?
So to start with, the resumption of a meaningful strategic dialogue between the United States and Russia, and the beginning of a meaningful strategic dialogue with China and the United States. You know, the United States is willing to have that conversation. Right now, neither the Chinese nor the Russians are. But in terms of what would make me feel better, as a first step, it would be the resumption of a meaningful dialogue, a meaningful discussion between those states.
James Acton is co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, getting us up to speed on nuclear nonproliferation in 2023 on the agenda of the G7 summit in Hiroshima. James, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Chile is setting a new standard for Latin America when it comes to some women's rights. Last month, it passed a law compensating the families of victims of femicide, the crime of killing a girl or woman because of their gender. The new law is part of a push by Chilean President Gabriel Boric for a more progressive agenda in his country. Beatriz Garcia-Nice is an associate with the Latin America program at the Wilson Center. Beatriz, tell us about this new law passed in Chile. How does it work?
So basically what this law does is, as you clearly mentioned, it recognizes the fact that families, after the killing of a woman because of a gender, many of them are already mothers, give some sort of support to their children and the family. It is part of President Boric's progressive agenda, but also the result of a very important feminist movement that originated in Argentina, but that it spilled over to many countries in the region, Chile being one of them, and they have really materialized and taken a lot of support from the population and the current government.
I can see the benefit to families of victims of femicide, but can this law cut down on femicides?
As it is, one law does not necessarily reduce the rate of, you know, femicide crimes and gender-based violence, like not at all, but it does help, right? It visibilizes the problem and it takes away the impunity that these types of crimes used to have within the state.
Beatriz, how big of a problem would you say femicide is in Chile and Latin America as a whole?
It's endemic. You know, Chile is not one of the countries with the highest rates of femicide, but it is a big problem. In the region, just to give you a number, in 2021, over 4,000 women were killed just because of their gender, right? In the region, 12 women are killed every day just because of their gender. And these are just the reported and known cases. Many cases within more, indigenous populations or even LGBTQ populations are not reported. So it is an endemic problem. It is a social problem and it is an economic problem because the fact that the state and society does not support women in many ways also trickles down to that impunity of men thinking that they can just commit these crimes without any sort of repercussion.
What more do you think Latin American governments can do to lower the rates of femicide? And do you see other governments taking action?
What this, you know, feminist movement did successfully was to incorporate the needs of women to be part of the social change that needed to be done in Chile, right? So that is something that, you know, has been very successful in Chile. In 2020, right, Chile also passed a law called the Gabriela Law that set penalties for femicide from 15 years to life in prison, right? In many other countries, you know, the rates for femicide to go to prison are between 2 to 6 years if they are found guilty.
So in the past 5 years or so, it sounds like from what you're saying, Chile has kind of moved ahead of the curve.
It has, absolutely. And I mean, it's not the only one. Argentina, for example, has a similar law that also supports victims and their families of femicide. So it's not the only country advancing. Argentina has made important advances. Colombia as well in reproductive rights. Mexico, but there's still a lot to be done. And Chile can be seen as an example of how progressive and female-oriented policies can really support and protect women against this type of violence.
Beatriz Garcia-Nice is an associate with the Latin America program at the Wilson Center, where she's also the lead for the gender-based project. She joined us from Washington. Very good to have you with us, Beatriz. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Russia fired another 30 missiles at Ukraine last night. The Ukrainian military says 29 were intercepted. The one that got through in the southern region of Odessa killed at least one person. Despite ongoing attacks, Ukrainians around the world are celebrating their cultural heritage today. It's a holiday known as Vishivanka Day. The Vishivanka is an elaborately embroidered shirt or dress, one of Ukraine's best-known symbols. From Kyiv, the world's Daniel Hoffman has more.
Ukraine is a country at war, but in the heart of the capital city at Inpushiv, fashion is king. Inpushiv is a men's fashion brand known for its high-end custom-tailored suits. The Inpushiv headquarters has a bar and a members-only barbershop. That's where I meet Katerina.
My name is Katerina Vozyanova. I'm the owner of Inpushiv brand. So we're working in Ukraine for 14 years already.
Inpushiv started small, with just 3 people. But over time, the company kept growing.
We were growing like hell. Before the war started, the full-scale war, we had 74 people, so we were big.
Vozyanova says the company has lost about a dozen employees. Some of them left the country, others joined the military. But that's not the only thing that changed about Inpushiv.
I realized that bespoke suits is no longer the option for us because in the nearest future, no one will need them.
$2,000 business suits just weren't going to sell, so the company pivoted. It started producing more traditional clothing.
Before war, we didn't do any vishivankas at all, and we started it. It is called military vishivanka.
Vozyanova shows me some examples. At first glance, they look pretty typical. Embroidered patterns, colorful and comfortable. But some of them are army green, and if you look closely, there's a twist.
So it's a mix of a classic style,
yeah,
but also modern depictions. We see a tank here.
Yeah. So for me, for our brand, the idea is to translate that we are going through war. This is why on this Vishivanka, you can see all this military machine, tanks, the resistance and the unity of our people.
Some of the other Vishivankas depict drones or military symbols. Vozyanova says it's important for her brand to reflect this moment in history when many Ukrainians are rediscovering their national identity.
Before the war, it meant nothing to me because I didn't felt that I need to emphasize that I'm Ukrainian. Right now, it's changed completely because it's the symbol of Ukrainian struggle, everything we are going through right now, and the changes inside yourself and inside everyone.
Across town, I meet a different type of Vishivanka enthusiast.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Hi.
Roxoliana Hira lives in the trendy Podil neighborhood of Kyiv with her family and their 2 dogs, Kobe and Spicy. Hira collects Vishivankas. Dozens of them are laid out on the dining room table.
First, I started to buy books about embroidery and about Vishivanka and about Ukrainian culture. And those books open a galaxy of Ukrainian culture for me.
Hira was inspired. She started going to flea markets and joined Vishivanka collector groups on social media.
I wanted to find Vishivankas from each region of Ukraine, and it was my aim. And I'm almost there.
Hira remembers growing up in western Ukraine when her family would wear Vishivankas on special occasions, like Christmas and Easter.
I was born in Soviet Union, actually. It was prohibited to celebrate all the religious holidays, so we still gathered at our granny's house, and we wear Vishivankas as a protest and a sign we remember our roots.
These days, Hira says she's dabbling in some traditional embroidery herself.
I started my first Vishivanka last year during the air alarms because while I was sitting in the corridor or safe place, you have nothing to do because it's very difficult to start reading because you're a little bit stressed.
Just sitting with the needle and thread, she says, can be therapeutic and a welcome distraction. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A comedy company in China is being fined more than $2 million because of a joke made by a stand-up comedian named Li Haoshu. A cell phone video captured the moment. Li jokes about watching 2 street dogs fight a squirrel, then references an 8-character Chinese military slogan coined by President Xi Jinping. The rough translation, fight well, win the battle. As you heard, it got the room laughing. A clip of the joke went viral on social media. Then Beijing accused the comedian of harming society and slapped that massive fine on him. Ben Frank knows the risks of doing stand-up in China. He got his comedy start in Shanghai in 2015, then traveled across China doing shows before moving back to the U.S. He's now a full-time comedian living in New York, performing in both English and Mandarin. I asked him, current controversy aside, what is the stand-up comedy scene like in China?
When I was living in China, especially when I started in 2015, the scene in Shanghai was great. It was a place where, as a beginner with little experience, you were able to get a lot of high-quality stage time. And there were also a lot of amazing people living in Shanghai from all over the world. So a lot of unique perspectives that you were able to gather, which was, again, kind of great for getting better at comedy.
Right. Well, Shanghai is a big cosmopolitan city. Beijing is the capital political administrative center. Do you find the same scene and audiences in both places?
There's a little bit of difference. I do think you definitely felt the presence of government more in Beijing as the years went on. The first time I went to China was actually back in 2010 when I studied abroad in Beijing. And back then, Beijing did not feel as politicized as it does now. But at the same time, over the time I was there, Shanghai had a lot more issues with comedy in terms of government intervention than Beijing did.
What did that look like for you?
So I started in 2015. About 3 years later, during an open mic, the club that I had belonged to basically got raided by the local culture bureau and was forced to shut down immediately and never reopened.
Why were they a target?
We were never told explicitly, and that's kind of how things operate in China. You're never really given an explanation for things like that. But the best guess would be, you know, we had brought out a lot of headliners from the U.S. We were doing monthly tours around China, and we were getting a bigger profile probably on local social media and things like that. So whenever you start to get more popular and you get on the radar a bit, all of a sudden the authorities might be a little more conscious of you. You know, they might see you as a little bit more of a threat, especially when you're potentially giving people a platform in public with a microphone to be saying things that haven't been vetted. You just never know what's going through the minds of both local and national or provincial bureaucrats. Whoever was in charge felt the need to put an end to it.
So, Ben, when you heard about this story of a comedian in China being fined $2 million, were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised at all, because the nature of enforcement of really any laws in China is pretty capricious and arbitrary. It doesn't necessarily, just because the person got fined, it doesn't really even mean that their joke was wrong in any way or that they violated some specific law that's on the books. It's all about perception. And if there's the perception that this person was making fun of the government or making fun of the president or making fun of the military, even if that's not what they were intending to do, they, as the government, need to put a stop to that to show that that's not all right, that's not acceptable, or other people will become more brave and emboldened to take similar actions in the future.
Is the possibility of getting in trouble with the government sort of always looming over the comedy scene in China?
Yeah, really, for the whole time I was there, it was always in the background. And it was in the back of my mind for most or the whole time I did comedy there, which was kind of why I personally took advantage of every bit of stage time I could get, because I thought to myself, this could all be gone tomorrow. My free speech or my right to do this is not protected by any laws here. If they want to take this away from me, it would be completely within their power to do so.
You said earlier that you appreciated the low-stakes environment, longer set times to work your craft. I'm wondering if there was ever a joke you told or didn't tell where you had been workshopping it at home and you wondered, oh, should I, shouldn't I?
That definitely crossed your mind at some point while you were there in China. I mean, but to be honest with you, I usually didn't write a whole lot of stuff that related to the Chinese government or things like that. I think for a lot of us who were in the scene a long time, we understood the stakes involved. And you really, for the most part, if you had a thought of an idea about the government or about politicians or stuff, you almost wouldn't even start writing it. You would just throw it out of your mind because you would think, there's no way I could ever do this to, you know, I can't do this in China. But I also, if I can't do this in China, no crowd outside of China is going to appreciate this either, because it's about something they don't really know or understand or care about. So you would almost kind of throw it out, what people kind of don't really think about in terms of the censorship in China in terms of performing arts or something like this is the vast majority of it is self-censorship, because you understand that there is a potential price to the things you say. And you know, if you want to maintain your performance space and your ability to get on stage, it's in your best interest to follow what you perceive the rules to be, or else you're going to jeopardize that for not only yourself, but everybody else in the scene.
Do you feel like the scene in China has changed since you started in 2015? Has it gotten stricter?
It's changed completely. So in China, for a show, a stand-up comedy show, to be 100% legal, the scripts of the performers need to go through approval from the Culture Bureau ahead of time. You would need to submit like a video and a script of what you intend to say, and they need to approve it in order for it to be 100% legal. Now, back in 2015, in the first few years I did comedy, we didn't do any of that for any of our shows because they were so small that nobody really cared. We promoted it, we did whatever. It was really fine for the most part for a few years until it wasn't, which is really kind of what happens in China, is that there's really no rule of law. Things are just, it just depends on what's enforced by whoever's in charge. So things are all right until they're not. And you really only find out they're not when someone gets in trouble for something.
Right. Ben, so much of comedy is about punching up and challenging authority, being irreverent. How do you think the government's kind of tightening grip is going to impact the material of your fellow comedians?
It's already having a huge effect because of what I just mentioned now compared to when I started. A much higher percentage of the stage time people are doing has gone through the censors. Like whatever material they're doing on stage has been submitted to the Culture Bureau and approved. What people may not realize is that these censors or the material that you're submitting, they're not just looking for things that might be about the Chinese government or against the Chinese government. They're censoring things that might be overly sexual, vulgar, have elements of LGBT culture. So the comedy that's coming out at a lot of these more of these live shows that are happening now in China is going to be a lot more kind of sanitized. Most people don't feel comfortable putting on shows that they've promoted that haven't been approved by the Bureau, because just the risk is too high and the chance of getting shut down is very high.
Ben Frank is a stand-up comedian in New York. He used to perform comedy in China. Thank you very much for being with us. Really appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it as well.
You're with the world. In Bogota, Colombia, people sorting through trash work long hours with little return and under tough conditions. But after banding together, their work life has improved. This waste picker says he now gets gloves, a face mask, and boots, and a better wage. Trash Pickers Unite in Colombia, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. We all know cars pollute. I mean, you can see the exhaust from the tailpipe. But cars also emit another form of pollution that we don't think a lot about, the tiny bits of rubber that wear off the tire. And you don't need to be showing off to be spewing those bits into the environment. Constant friction on asphalt means fine tire dust makes its way into the air, the soil, and waterways. In some cities, residents are inhaling more tire dust than tailpipe fumes. And the problem could get worse. With more electric vehicles on the roadway weighed down by heavy batteries, tires are expected to wear out up to 50% faster than on cars with combustion engines. Gunnlaugr Erlendsson, who goes by G, is the CEO of UK-based tire startup Enso and has been looking into what can be done. I know that tires wear down, G, but I never really considered where it all goes. Explain what happens.
Basically, what happens when a tire meets the road or the rubber meets the road, we have friction as we drive, as we roll on the streets, as we turn, as we stop, and as we accelerate. Each one of them generates effectively fine dust from the tire. And this fine dust sometimes is so fine that it's airborne. And these particles are so fine that until very recently, they'd not even been captured or measured. But in the last few years, there's been an enormous amount of research into this. We're now at the stage in the UK where the environmental agencies have confirmed we're breathing more tire dust than tailpipe dust. This is one of the larger sources of microplastic pollution from the Western world into our oceans.
One big problem seems to be the antioxidant added to tires to prevent cracking. Tell us about that and the impacts of this product on the environment.
So this has been mainly research done in California and the West Coast of the United States on a material called 6-PPD. And the researchers there have identified the toxicity nature of this in terms of salmon population and other species of fish. Effectively, for years, there were these mass die-offs in estuaries along the western coast of the United States. But nobody could explain why these die-offs would suddenly happen until fairly recently, where it was connected, of course, to this material called 6-PPD, which is commonly used in most tires as effectively a preservative for the tire itself over its life. Once it rains, this material, which has been then, of course, on the roads, get washed through the drains into these estuaries and effectively causes these massive die-offs. And of course, this is something that the tire industry is not really keen to discuss. But ultimately, when we're looking at this, this has much wider implications in terms of including looking now at human health.
Now, with electric vehicles that have heavy batteries that weigh much more than a combustion engine, that's going to wear out tires even faster. Is that going to make this problem worse? Is that inevitable?
Yes. We, of course, know EVs are heavier, and simple physics dictates that a heavier vehicle will wear tires faster. So with EVs, you have generally higher wear. Michelin says up to 20% faster. Goodyear has stated up to 50% faster.
Well, some governments are trying to do something about this. The European Union is planning to set standards for tire emissions. California is going to require tire makers to explore alternatives. Is the global tire industry, though, ready for change?
To be honest, they have to be forced to change, just like we had other tailpipe regulations since the 70s. And California, of course, led the charge in that regard when it set some of the world's first air pollution standards. But that's over 50 years ago when that started to tick along. So you can imagine how long it might take. We don't have enough time like that anymore to address this problem. The tire industry has to, of course, embrace the problem and work with regulators to solve it. But to be honest, today there is no law anywhere on this planet against making tires that wear out really quickly or are inherently toxic, apart from some minor regulations. But of course, it's highly profitable to sell tires that are made out of cheaper raw materials that you get to sell more often because they wear out quickly. Underlying the whole industry, of course, is a business model that focuses on churn.
Right. And so how do we get around that? That seems to be a fundamental problem with all this.
It is the fundamental problem because while the business model of both the manufacturers of tires and the distributors of tires are focused on selling more tires, ultimately, what we need to focus on here is changing the underlying incentives. And so selling directly to the customer is something Enzo is developing. And we also then look to sell these tires as a service to customers. Because once we provide the tire onto the vehicle as a service, something very fundamental happens. And that is we convert the business model from the churn to durability. Because the longer you can make that tire last, the less pollution it'll generate.
So is it possible to make tires out of something other than rubber?
Well, rubber comes in two formats. You have synthetic rubber, which comes from the fossil fuel industry, and you have natural rubber, which comes from trees. The rubber that is synthetic and comes from fossil fuels has a really high carbon input to manufacture, while the one that grows on trees actually sequesters carbons. So actually, we want more natural rubber and less synthetic rubber. The irony is, of course, all cars today, and including all electric cars, run on tires made from fossil fuels. So even if we switch all cars to EVs tomorrow, we end up still having to pump oil out of the ground to make the tires. If we see a carbon neutral future in front of us, we have to reduce, of course, our reliance on fossil fuels and more relying on renewable recycled. So as we make tires more efficient and less polluting, we can actually hope for a better future.
Gun lawyer Erlendsson heads the UK-based tire startup Enso. It's looking into what can be done to make tires more environmentally friendly. Thanks very much for your insight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Picking through trash to look for things that have some recycling value. You may know people who come through your own neighborhood and do this. It goes without saying that it's dirty, dangerous, backbreaking work. It's also something that millions of people do each day across the globe. These waste pickers are often at the bottom of the social ladder. In Colombia, though, they've organized to demand better pay and working conditions. Today, part three of our series about waste pickers. Check out our stories from earlier in the week from Ghana and India at theworld.org. Today, we're off to Bogota, where Manuel Rueda begins his report walking us through a tragic set of events that brought waste pickers together.
Medical students need cadavers to learn on. It was no different at Barranquilla's Universidad Libre. Several campus guards back in 1992 came up with a way to help the medical school and themselves. On quiet nights over a period of months, waste pickers were invited onto campus to collect old cans and cardboard boxes, but it was a trap. The guards beat them with bats and shot them, according to court documents. Then they sold the bodies to the medical school. But one waste picker didn't die. After he was put in a bathtub full of formaldehyde, he escaped. The following day, police found the bodies of 11 waste pickers in the university's morgue. Marisol Mogollón is a waste picker in Bogotá.
Es como un dolor que llevamos los recicladores porque pues la gente es tanta su falta.
It's something that still makes us feel pain, just to think that we were treated as disposable beings.
The crime shocked the nation, but also galvanized waste pickers in Colombia. They went from being one of the nation's most marginalized groups to fighting for their rights in the streets and in courts. Colombia is now a global leader when it comes to granting rights to these workers, says Federico Parra, an urban anthropologist who specializes in grassroots organizations.
And this creates a huge movement that impuls the waste pickers organization to fight for their rights. And after 20 years, they achieve the recognition as providers of the recycling service.
Nowadays, waste pickers in Colombia are recognized as public service providers, and they can go anywhere in the city to collect goods that can be recycled without fear. Though many still get around on foot pulling heavy wooden carts, they have formed associations that own trucks and collect trash at designated points. Alfredo Rodriguez is a waste picker in Chapinero, a wealthy district in the north of Bogotá. When I was starting out, we had to go all the way to the center of the city to sell our trash in warehouses, he says. The city center is about 7 miles away. Rodriguez says the job pays little and it requires long hours, but he says that slowly conditions have been improving. We used to fight over trash bags in the street. Now it's more orderly, and we also get gloves, face masks, and boots with steel tips. In Bogota, waste pickers don't just get paid for what they sell to warehouses each day. They also get a monthly fee that comes from a local waste management tax. Sandra Martinez is a waste picker in Usme, a district at the southern edge of Bogota.
We get anywhere from $30 to $90 from the monthly fee, depending on how much we gathered. It's not much, but it helps to pay the bills.
At the end of the month, waste pickers' associations also get paid a fee, which varies according to how many tons their members collected. Jorge Ospina is the director of Araus, the Waste Pickers Association in Bogotá's Usme district. His association has 75 members and gets about $5,000 a month from local taxes. Thanks to the monthly fees, our association has enough money to rent 3 warehouses, and we've also bought a truck, he says. At one of the warehouses, 2 employees strip labels away from hundreds of plastic bottles so that they can sell them to a local recycling plant. There's no longer any need to sell the trash to middlemen, and the association's members can get better prices for what they collect. But waste pickers in the city still face many challenges. Prices for some items, like cardboard, have fallen recently. And for some waste pickers, it's also become harder to get decent amounts of trash. Martinez says many Venezuelan migrants who are out of work are also roaming the streets of Bogotá, looking for items that can be sold to recycling plants.
They open the trash bags before we can get to them. And with the economic crisis, even homeowners are holding on to stuff and selling it themselves to warehouses.
But the biggest challenge for Bogotá's waste pickers are large contractors that are also trying to get a piece of the recycling business. Still, for many waste pickers in Bogotá, like Sandra Martinez, this is an industry that changed for the better, even if these transformations were sparked by a horrible set of murders.
Y al menos nosotros somos reconocidos. Antes éramos, ah, que mira el desechable.
Our job has more recognition now. We used to be perceived as junkies or disposable people, but now our role in the city is respected.
For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Bogotá.
Tomorrow, our series on the people who take care of our trash goes to Japan, where kimono-clad, sword-wielding eco-warriors have turned garbage collecting into a choreographed performance. In Malawi, in southern Africa, for nearly a decade now, about 1,200 children from Rastafarian families have not been allowed to attend public schools. That's because of their dreadlocks. The public schools in Malawi have an old rule banning dreadlocks on the faulty assumption they're unhygienic. But Malawi's high court recently overturned the prohibition on dreadlocks. Noah Kaisi is a Rastafarian dad living in northern Malawi and has been pushing to get kids with dreadlocks back in school. And Noah, this is personal for you, right? You've got kids with dreadlocks in school, correct?
Yeah.
And how have your kids been getting educated if they can't attend public school?
It wasn't easy, but maybe for my kids it was easier because it's like a private school, you know? It's just like business. They don't care how you look like as long as you manage to pay them for the fees or whatever.
Were there kids who missed out on school completely because of this rule?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Because for me, yeah, I know they've been coming, you know, like, ah, daddy, I want to shave my dreadlocks. I said, like, what? I want to shave my dreadlocks. I want to look like my friends at school. I said, like, no, but that's the way I choose. So you don't need like, to trim your dreadlocks. Because we're family, that's how we're supposed to look like.
So for you and your kids, how does it feel knowing they can go to public school if they want to now?
Yeah, it sounds good. It sounds good. Because even me, I was like, what's up with the system? You know, because everybody in life, you choose the way of life. You feel like, because we have Muslims, we have the Buddhism, we have Christians, you know, but all of them, they're allowed to go attend the education. But only Rasta child, they don't want to accept him to go for education. So even me, I was asking myself, so what's going on, you know? And now I'm happy because we've been fighting for it for quite long. The mission has been fulfilled, you know? So we give thanks.
Yeah. I got to say, I'm also thinking about some of the kids who missed out on an education, the ones you were talking about a moment ago. If they are, say, for example, 15 years old right now,
yeah,
will they be able to access the grade level that is right for a 15-year-old?
I know it's not easy, but it's more if they'll be allowed, you know, like to go there. And, you know, teachers, they know where to start with.
Right.
Because a teacher is just like a second parent, you know.
Do you think the state has a responsibility to make up for the damage the rule caused?
You know, I know it's not easy because for me, sometimes I can blame the system, you know. People who control the system, people who are in the government, sometimes they're stingy, you know.
Are you motivated now to get your kids into public school or are they settled and happy where they are now?
My worries was for my fellow Malawians who are can't afford to send their kids to the private school and they're denied to send their kids to the government school. So that was my big worries. So even my fight was for the fellow Malawians, because I know like me, I can afford to send them to the private school. Each one teach one, you know. If they want to know us, that means we need to be together, close to each other. But why they always take us away? I can even feel it, you know, because they have friends, you know, there. And sometimes they can ask me, daddy, can you allow us maybe to go for sleep over to this other guy? And me, I try to call the parents just to link up, like, can you allow this? You know, but most of the parents, they always ignore, you know, because they know like I'm a laster, they judge me like the way they feel themselves or whatever, you know. But me, I don't care because I know what I'm doing. I love my life. I love my family. I love my kids. I know it's still existing, you know, though government has accepted the dreadlocks to go to school, but still some other parents, they still have that mentality of just judging Rasta. So me now, I'm happy because I'm just an ordinary Malawian as well. Mm. And I know it's my poor country. And if I don't have a chance for my kids to go to the government school, where else can I take them if education is the key and the government is a pressing raster? The vision of Marcus Garvey has been fulfilled, you know?
Mm. Marcus Garvey, of course, one of the great leaders of Rastafari.
Yeah, man.
Well, certainly for those families who can't afford private school, it is a brand new day. Noah Kaisi is a Rastafarian dad in Malawi. He's been speaking with me about an old rule forbidding dreadlocks and, as a result, keeping Rastafarian children away from primary school education. That rule has now been lifted. Noah Kaisi, wonderful to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Bless up. Nice to talk to you as well.
In Sudan, two generals are locked in a lethal battle. For years, they've operated in the country with impunity. Yesterday, we brought you part one of our profile of General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hameti. He's been accused of being directly involved in genocide in the Darfur region of Sudan. Luis Moreno Ocampo, former chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court, told us that there was never enough pressure from the international community to nab him.
The problem is not Hameti. The problem is Hameti is the normal consequence of the system.
Today, we bring you part two of the story behind Hameti's rise, how he went from being the head of a ragtag paramilitary group to a general vying for control of all of Sudan. Here's the world's Chris Harlan Dunaway.
One secret to Hameti's success, he keeps his circle small.
He has used his close family members around him as his trusted confidants, and he has built a business empire for himself, making him one of the richest Africans on the continent, apparently.
That's Cameron Hudson. He's been in the room with Hameti. He was a former aide to the State Department's special envoys to Sudan, and he worked for the National Security Council. And Hudson says how Hameti made his money was no secret. Hameti used his personal army, the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, to seize gold mines in Darfur. He hired his fighters out to Libya, the UAE, in Saudi Arabia. You might think he only takes shady mercenary money. Not so.
Let's not forget that in 2015, the European Union gave Hameti and the RSF over 100 million euros to develop a kind of a border police to prevent the flow of migrants through Sudan. 100 million euros.
Here's something you might not expect about Hameti. He's got away with people. A European diplomat once told Hudson a story about having breakfast with Hameti.
The diplomat commented on the quality of the honey that was served at breakfast, and Hameti told him that the honey came from his personal beehives in Darfur.
Much later, when he was back in Europe, he got really sick.
The next day, a large pot of honey was delivered to this diplomat in his hospital room in Europe with a note, handwritten note, from Hameti, wishing him a speedy recovery.
All this time, Hameti was doing the bidding of the country's autocratic president, Omar al-Bashir, even when that included gunning down civilians. His reward? Moving up the ranks in the military, and closer to the seat of power.
And by the time he arrived in Khartoum, I think it was largely too late for us to impede that path.
Eventually, al-Bashir's grip on power started to wane. In 2019, pro-democracy protesters demanded that he resign. Hameti and a bunch of other military leaders stepped in and threw Bashir out. And they were in no mood to tolerate any dissent. On June 3rd, 2019, there was a peaceful sit-in protest in Khartoum. Police and troops wearing RSF desert fatigues shot their way through a huge protest encampment on one of Khartoum's wide boulevards. More than 100 people were killed.
They were finding bodies in the Nile for weeks, months, and could probably still find bodies weighted down in the Nile.
Eric Reeves is an author and lecturer on Sudan. He's followed both Hameti and the revolution closely.
But there were far too many witnesses.
Hameti was immediately implicated in the killings. Despite that, he became part of the coalition government with the new civilian prime minister and the general of the Sudanese armed forces, Abdel Fattah el-Burhan. They said it would only be temporary, and the State Department was willing to gamble on their promises.
They believed that Burhan and Hameti would, in fact, turn over power to the civilians.
That's Susan Page. She was the first ambassador to the newly created country of South Sudan. Insiders told her what happened. Two former officials confirmed this to me too. The truth was, the transition to civilian rule was stumbling, and everyone recognized that. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, was trying to keep the generals on course.
Jeff Feltman got on the plane after having Burhan and Hemeti literally promise him, no, we're serious about this, touches ground, and the first thing they tell him is, they've launched a coup.
The generals played him. A senior source told me that. Did the generals' broken promises or even security forces' attacks on civilians lead to personal repercussions for them? No. The U.S. did impose sanctions on Sudan's police force, but there was no punishment that targeted just the generals. A former diplomat who negotiated with Burhan and Hemeti told me, the generals are clearly contemptuous of their own civilians. That's a quote. Even still, Ambassador Page was surprised by what happened next.
I could not believe that Mali Fee was getting on a plane to go talk to the generals shortly after they launched the coup.
Page is talking about Mali Fee, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
A number of us were just outraged.
To be fair to Mali Fee, the National Security Council was involved in the decision too. But what was perhaps more damaging is it looked to the Sudanese civilians like the U.S. was too tight with the generals. The Americans' reputation as a fair and unbiased interlocutor was slipping. We reached out to the State Department several times for our stories on the Sudanese generals, and specifically about Ambassador Page's remarks, but didn't hear back. But several former State Department officials familiar with Sudan at the time said the U.S. worked with people known to have committed atrocities because transitioning to a civilian government was worth it. It's not an unusual cost-benefit calculation. And maybe it really was too late to do anything about Hemeti. Cameron Hudson, the former NSC official and State Department aide on Sudan, responded to this point of view when I brought it up.
That's faulty logic because we're creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. By not delegitimizing him, by not stripping him of his power and authority and leverage, he only grows stronger.
Hemeti thought he was so strong, so close to the throne, as it were, that last month he launched a coup against General Burhan, the head of the Sudanese army. And now you can hear the clap of machine guns in the streets of Khartoum and airstrikes on the city from above as the two generals fight for control. On May 4th, President Biden issued an executive order paving the way for possible sanctions targeting the generals. Hemeti is still not on the sanctions list. For The World, I'm Chris Harlan Dunaway.
Our Sudan reporting continues online at theworld.org. The show comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.